This is Ben Smith. I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hey folks, this is Ben. You're listening to episode 103 of my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Don't forget, if you're a regular listener and you think this podcast might be worth the price of a cup of coffee per episode, then please do sign up for a small recurring monthly subscription, or if you prefer, make a larger occasional donation at bensmithphoto.com/a small voice. Do please leave a positive review on iTunes so that others may find out about the podcast. And if you should happen to be in need of a new website, I can sort that out for you using the Squarespace platform so that you don't have to waste a lot of time and energy figuring out how to do it yourself. So hi folks, nice to have you along. My chat this week is with the one and only Todd Hydo, who I had the pleasure of spending time with during my recent visit to the Chico Portfolio Review event in the United States. Before I introduce Todd properly, there are a few items of housekeeping to get through, so please bear with me. Don't skip ahead, kids, it's important. I'm pleased to announce that joining the Charcoal Book Club and Finder this week, we have a brand new sponsor. Those of you who are good at doing complex mathematics in your head will have calculated that that makes three sponsors altogether. Now, to be honest, I did consider carefully whether maybe two was the maximum I should have. I don't want to inundate you with sponsor messages, but the truth is that they are what allows you, the lovely listener, to enjoy the podcast completely free of charge. So I thought about it, and I do think this company is a great fit for A Small Voice. They do have a great service that many of you will find incredibly useful. So three sponsors it is, and I promise you here and now that there will never be more than that. So without further ado, this episode is sponsored by PicDrop. PicDrop is an image transfer tool aimed at professional photographers and founded by a professional photographer along with a designer from Germany. It is the easiest and fastest way to send photos to your clients, collaborate on edits and much more. With PicDrop, you're not drearily delivering zip files to your customers. Instead, you're sending them an interactive gallery where they can rate, comment on, select and download full resolution files. Easily upload your images and let PicDrop do the rest. Now, like many such web-based services, PicDrop operates on a freemium model, so it's totally free for the basic plan, which may be the only plan you ever need. So you have nothing to lose by trying it out. And what's more, if you sign up at picdrop.de, you will not only get a month's free trial with all the features enabled, but use the coupon code ASMALLVOICE and you'll also get an extra 2 months of PicDrop premium on top of that. So try it out. It is a really cool product. I can see it being useful for many of you. Or click on the show notes in the website and that will take you directly to PicDrop's website. This episode of the podcast is also brought to you by the excellent Charcoal Book Club, the first and only Book of the Month club dedicated exclusively to photo books. Each month, Charcoal works with the most respected names in contemporary photography to select a first edition monograph that is a must-have for every collection. Each book arrives signed by the artist along with a note card and print from an esteemed guest curator with free shipping to the US, Canada and the UK. All that, along with members-only pricing in their online bookstore and more, makes the Charcoal Book Club the best and most exciting way to stay up to date with essential work in contemporary photography. I'm looking forward to receiving April's book, which is Atari Pristine Peaks by Keiko Nomura. Now, I did see it in Montana, but I refused to look at it on the grounds that that would spoil my enjoyment of seeing it for the first time when it arrives at my door in a week or two. Does that make sense to you? Makes sense to me. Finally, this episode is sponsored by the equally excellent Finder.me, that's F-I-N-D-R.me, which is a two-sided marketplace for imaging professionals, providing clients with direct access to thousands of experienced photographers on a single platform, and in turn introducing photographers to hundreds of potential clients. Finder connects photographers with relevant customers based on location and type of photography services offered. Photographers can sign up quickly and easily and for free for corporate contracts at fixed rates, or they can set their own pricing to attract direct clients. And in contrast to some of their larger competitors, the people at Finder care about you, the photographer, and are committed to total transparency in the way that they do business. Finder is basically for everyone in the photography business, from wedding planners to artists. And if you are a photographer, regardless of what type of photographer you may be, go and open an account, start filling out your profile, and open up a whole new way of finding new work, finding new clients, and finding new opportunities. Join up for free at Finder.me and get found. Just one more thing I wanted to mention before I introduce Todd. There are a couple of photo book Kickstarter campaigns that I wanted to mention very quickly. One is by Jasper White. It's called Tour Eiffel. Very cool project. Have a look at it. Just type in Jasper White to the search box on Kickstarter. It'll come up. The other one is 209 Women, which was a great project. Recently had an exhibition here in London. 209 female MPs were photographed by 209 British or Brit-based women photographers. That's going to be a book. That's close to being funded, so they might not need help, but it's always good to go there if you fancy supporting that project and perhaps pre-ordering a book. Check out those two Kickstarter campaigns. So Todd Hyder is an American photographer born in Ohio and who for many years has been based in the San Francisco Bay Area. He received a BFA from Tufts University in Massachusetts and an MFA from the California College of Arts and Crafts. He is currently an adjunct professor at the California College of Art in San Francisco. Todd's images have featured in many publications, have been exhibited widely, and are included in various prestigious public and private collections, most notably Pier 24 Photography in San Francisco, which holds the archive of all his published works. He's over a dozen published books to his name, including a mid-career survey entitled Intimate Distance, 25 Years of Photographs, published in 2016 by Aperture. And his most recent monograph is Bright Black World, which was released by Nasrelli Press last year in 2018 and is already sold out. So if you should stumble upon a copy of that, buy it immediately because it's already worth a lot of money. So, as I said, this chat took place during the Charcoal Book Club's recent Chico Review in Montana. I have five other such chats to bring you in the coming weeks from some of the other guest speakers and reviewers who were there. There will also be a special episode up next, which I'm currently still editing, so tune in for that in 2 weeks' time. But in the meantime, here's a brilliant Todd Hyder. It is, alas, a much shorter chat than you're used to hearing, because the schedule was somewhat packed, and by the time we spoke, on the very last day of the event, there simply wasn't that much time in which to do it. So that is just what it is, unfortunately. But 40 minutes of Todd Hyder is most certainly better than no Todd Hyder at all. So here he is. Okay, we're finally good. Thank God.
Okay.
Sorry about the faffing about, Todd. I don't want to waste a minute, really.
Sure.
You know, I wanted to talk to you about the thing that I've noticed has been really notable this week is like the way in which you really use every opportunity to go and shoot. And, you know, I don't know if that's a kind of self-discipline thing or whether it's just in you that it's something you're kind of driven to do. But it's just really struck me, and it's very inspirational that it's almost like you feel like, you know, that you're on sort of borrowed time almost, that you just want to go and work.
Yeah.
Have you always been like that?
Well, actually, I will say this. It's because of where we are.
Right.
You know, and also if you notice today, I don't have that feeling because it's sunny.
Right. So the light is wrong for you.
The light is wrong for me. And then also the fact that it was cloudy, and then that when it was snowing, it was like, I'm out of here, you know, and to go take pictures. And that's what I've done. And those, the 2 days that we've had, like, I have gone because, you know, to take pictures. I can't help myself. Mm. But if we were in London and it was sunny, or if we're in New York and, like, you know, there's nothing, like the environment is like buildings, like I wouldn't even be bothered by shooting.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So it's not, it's really the place.
Yeah. The place and the right environment.
The right light.
But I imagine you do have quite a work ethic in terms of making sure that you're constantly out there producing something.
Yeah.
Is that something you have to cultivate?
No, I think that, I guess one could cultivate that, but I mean, for me, it's either like, I've just always kind of had that, you know. Mm. I'm sort of like, I feel like idle when I'm just sitting around. I don't ever like sit around and do anything, like, and just watch. I mean, I'll watch things on television, but like, I'd rather be doing something, you know. Yeah,
it was fascinating to hear you give your presentation. I wanted to ask you about the ways in which your kind of formative experiences have kind of fed into your work as time's gone on. Mm-hmm. So where did you grow up?
I grew up in Kent, Ohio. It's a small college town in northeastern Ohio, kind of in the middle of the suburbs. Well, actually in a suburb built into the middle of cornfields.
Yeah. And what are your kind of, you know, overriding memories of of childhood. Did you enjoy school? What kind of kid were you? That kind of
thing? I did not enjoy school at all. You know, in fact, I didn't like school in any way whatsoever until I discovered photography.
Uh-huh.
And then I was excited to go to school because I was like, oh, I can go to the dark room. We can make some, I can make something. I was really excited by that. And everything sort of snapped into place when that discovery occurred.
Wow. So that was when it happened at school?
Yeah, the first time. I was honestly like a C and D student.
Right, right.
You know, yeah.
And then you found this thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Which some people never do.
That graduated from the dean's list.
Right.
Wow. Honors, yeah. Wow. All that.
You talked about how you used to, you know, race BMX bikes, and that was something that you photographed your mm-hmm. friends doing that. Was that your first subject matter?
It was definitely the first subject matter. It was the kind of thing like you know, with every kid and an iPhone and a skateboard today, like, you know, like you, they have to record what occurs, otherwise to share it, you know, and like we didn't quite have that impulse wasn't honed the way that people are today, but like. We just wanted to simply be like to capture what we were doing,
right.
And so we would pick up the camera and shoot each other and doing our jumps and stuff like that.
Yeah. You know. What did your parents make of your interest in photography? Did they encourage it? Did they understand it?
My mom always encouraged whatever I did, you know, yeah. and my dad never really he never really paid much attention to what it was I was doing, but. But I just, you know, of course I just went on and, you know, I did what I wanted. I don't know if I would call myself rebellious, but like, I've definitely just done what I've wanted to do and kind of not really worried about what they would think. Like I understand the pressure some people have with their parent, one of them to be a doctor or a lawyer or whatever. Like there was no pressure of any kind from my parents about anything.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Did you start to discover other photographers at that point? You know, did you start to look at photo books or have influences?
Yeah. Like very early on in school when I went to photo school, because that was the thing I was going to do. That's the one thing I knew I was going to do. Like when I discovered it, I was like, you know, convinced, and I just left like that fall to go to school and then never looked back.
Mm.
Yeah, photo books were definitely brought to my attention early on. You know, one of my teachers had given me a Robert Frank, The Americans, the book The Americans by Robert Frank. And that was, of course, you know, an early influence. And although my work is not really, like, I wouldn't say it's really anything like his work, he's always remained an influence, you know. And and I guess I don't know what it is exactly with his work, but that picture of Butte, Montana, speaking of being in Montana, out the window of the hotel room is just one of those pictures that I'll never forget, you know. And I think that it's those curtains in that photograph, you know, where you feel like he's got it's framed by the edge of the curtains, and you feel like Robert Frank is standing inside the hotel looking outside at the world. And because of the curtain scrim, you feel him.
Mm.
You feel like you're standing where he's standing. You can see his point of view. And I think that that's something that I took away from that. And I definitely utilized that in my work, you know, like you know, at first subconsciously, but like now I'm very aware that, like, you know, it's my breath on the window of the car that makes it foggy, you know, and, you know, stuff like that. So it's, and it's like, and there's a point of view that I think that the viewer relates to, because you feel like if you're looking through something, there has to be a human on the other end that's looking through it,
right.
You know, and that, I think that's where a lot of people connect to my pictures. It's like they feel like their memory, and that's the other thing about, like, and again, not all my photographs are blurry. I very consciously choose what's sharp, what's not sharp, and I you know, make almost all of my pictures sharp and not sharp, just to see what's better, because I don't know until I see it. But the thing about, oftentimes it ends up, like, part of it's sharp, part of it's fuzzy, just like our memories are.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I wanted to kind of jump forward to, you know, the thing that kind of got you started in a way, the pictures of houses at night, because we haven't got a huge amount of time, so mm-hmm. I wanted to get onto it. I mean,
sure.
How did that come about initially? What was the first impulse that caused you to go and shoot that?
The very first impulse that I to shoot that was, I had this class with Larry Salton and Lynn, a filmmaker at school, and it was called the Narrative Workshop. And it was a class where we were just, it was actually, it was when I was a grad student, but the class was so great that the grad students would take this undergraduate class. And we would, there was an assignment to like kind of piece together a narrative out of found photography that we just found in a thrift shop, and which is clearly a Larry Sultan assignment. And then I needed, I had the sequence, but I needed a place for these people, for the drama that I had curated, for them to be, it needed, they had to happen somewhere. And so I shot a house at night, you know, with a light on in the window, kind of indicating their presence, which curiously is like every TV sitcom in America, pretty much like they cut, you know, house at night for one right. second, they the, go the in, then they go inside.
Establishing shot, yeah,
the establishing shot. And that's what it is. It's an establishing shot that I made. And then what was curious, when you take away the other pictures that I was made it, that were intended to be the establishing shot for, and you just have the establishing shot, it's quite interesting when you start to make another one. And I made another one. And of course, I did not see this at when I made it. This is like my work and my thought process in photography is always developed out of making things and looking at them later and saying, oh, gee, look at that, you know, or like you're like, you know, you're the meaning emerges out of making,
right.
you know. And and so for me, that was how it started. I made one. And then I made another one, because that's the thing about photography. It's kind of like usually you don't make just one of something. And then you make another one, and then you make another one, and you're like, oh, there's something to this. Mm-hmm. Like, what happens when there's more? And then you just kind of keep going and doing that. And and I think that happens with me like in almost every body of work I've ever done.
And what was your state of mind, generally speaking, when it, you know, it seemed like a kind of, it's kind of a lonely thought that you're driving around at night, you know, finding these kind of slightly melancholy scenes. Were you, you know, is that a kind of false narrative, or was there, was that part of it? You know, this is.
I wouldn't say it's a forced narrative, but I would say that I'm not like an unhappy guy.
No, right,
you know?
Right.
Yeah. And, but also, I mean, you know, there's something to be said for like, you know, why does one drive around looking at houses at night slowly, like for 15 years, you know, I mean, there's like, there was no question that like I was chewing on something, you know? And then also curiously, you know, when does that like wind down a little bit? Because like there's with, you know, with the work, with all of my work, like there's periods of like, I discover something and I'll get really into it. And then I kind of figure out what I was thinking about, and then it sort of slows down. It doesn't always go away, you know, because I still make those pictures, you know, and there's like variation of them in this latest book of mine, but like from like 3,000 yards away, you know, but there are lights on in the distance. And then, but also at the same time, you know, I think then you're, you know, you're kind of working with what keeps you up at night, you know, whether it's conscious or not.
Yeah. So what were you chewing on, do you think? I mean, what kind of conclusion?
I was probably thinking about families and like other families and how other people live and what their lives are like and how do they, and what are their relationships like, you know, like relationship, I think is one of the key things I was thinking of. And, you know, I was very lucky to do these Raymond Carver book covers, who, you know, his writing is like, you know, incredibly, bleak about relationships. Yet when I read his books, like I see pictures, you know, when I read his poems, I'm like, they spill out of me. And so he has been an influence. And then I was very lucky to have been able to do like, the book covers for the reissues, the reissued, covers for his books, you know, which I kind of like, very luckily, and I felt like Raymond Carver's work was brought to a younger audience, you know, because of the pictures that were on the covers that were different, new, and reached other people, you know. And one of my favorite ones was What We Talk About When We Talk About Love. And it's just a picture of, you know, a car backed into a driveway. One of the car, an apartment building, one of them is, there's a place where a car had left, and there's one little light on in the window, and it's this odd little green building, with fluorescent lighting, and it's really kind of a strange, cold, crispy night, and you can tell that, you know, from the glitter on the ground of the snow. But you know, it's you know, something just happened there.
Yeah. So getting that commission was meant a lot to you because you just a fan of his work.
Yeah, I don't think they didn't have any idea how much I was a fan of his work.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Yeah, it was just like kind of one of those meant to be experiences.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'm wondering about sort of how people react to the House at Night, because it seems like, you know, when I look at them, you know, for me, it's a kind of, there's a melancholia about it. Mm-hmm. It's kind of heartbreaking in a way. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I can see I maybe other people find it kind of comforting in a way. You know, do you kind of find different reactions from people? You know,
absolutely. There's reactions all over the board, you know, and you're right. Some people find them to be very, you know, comforting, you know. Some people find them to be really like devastating, and for me, you know, I find them to be more like melancholy. Mm. But the thing that I always say about meaning in art is that like the meaning of the image resides in the viewer.
Yeah,
and I think that's a really true thing. It's like just like a music. Like, what's the meaning of a song? Well, I mean, it means a thousand different things to a thousand different people, and there's an intention of the artist. But that's not always what's the most important thing, you know.
Well, in a way, that's the, you know, when you create something that provokes completely different reactions in the viewer, then you've you know, in a way, you've achieved all you could ever really hope for, right?
Definitely, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. It's amazing if you can get like different meanings and you know, different readings of your work.
Yeah. Like, do you think you imagined yourself inside those houses at the time that you were taking the pictures? Sometimes.
You know, it sometimes, but like, not to even overanalyze it. Like, I was just excited to make pictures.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I'm like, oh my God, the light's on. I hope they don't find out
right,
or see me, or like, you know, and not that I was doing anything wrong, but like, sometimes, like, I actually swear, like, people feel you looking, you know, like they feel like, even though like they're in their house doing their life and like they can't really see outside, I swear they can feel like the presence of a stare, which is why I actually would never even look, you know, I wouldn't look in the direction. I would set my camera up really quickly, put it on the tripod, hope the light didn't get turned off, because there's decisive moments in all of this. I've always say, like, you know, like, there's decisive, landscapes are decisive moments. Light is a decisive, fleeting thing. You got to get it right when the time is right. And of course, at night, sometimes you have more of a span of even simple light. You know, when you're dealing with like humans in a household, like, you know, lights go on and off, like, and they move from room to room. And then, you know, I this was back in the days of TV, and like not on demand TV, but people would like, you know, I always remember 11:30 was like, lights were going to go out because everyone was done watching the evening news and they go to bed. You know, that's an American thing.
You know? So you knew.
Watch the 11 o'clock news, to bed at 11:30.
Right.
Yeah.
Again, you know, I think you're right. One shouldn't overanalyze and read too much into it. But do you feel like, or have you felt like an outsider?
Not really. Mm. No. I mean, because, again, like, I think the thinking about what's happening occurs later on.
Right.
You know, in the moment, I'm just making a picture. I'm a photographer that's excited that there's something in front of me that I've worked really hard to find. Because sometimes those pictures, like, drive around for 5 hours in a night, and like you get like two or three pictures if you're lucky. Mm. You know, yeah.
I mean, you talk to us about you know, you're not really coming at it from an academic point of view, and that you learned how to do commercial photography, basically. You know how to. Mm-hmm.
And in the beginning, that was my training. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just the technical aspects of photography, so you could make a living.
Yeah, and you sort of talked about how it's about, you know, getting things done, really.
Yeah.
I mean, is that a valuable thing for young photographers to do, even if they want ultimately to, you know, have their own kind of artistic practice?
I do think it is, but we're also back when I did it, and I mean, this was 1986 when I went to school first. It was, you know, I found it to be wise to have a solid set of skills, a mastery of a medium, you know, using, like, we just came from this talk, you know, where like people were using 8x10 cameras, people were using film cameras, they're using digital, they're using toy cameras. Like, you know, I felt like, and like my education in school was to utilize all of that and do it well. Mm. And so whenever I had an idea, I didn't have to like go find out how to do it. I already knew how to do it. And that was actually really valuable. I think in this day and age, like we live in the land of on-demand learning. Mm. And photography is that kind of thing where you can learn what you need to know when you need to know it technically. Mm. But there's also something about just kind of like understanding like the properties of light, you know, how to light something, you know, how to, we used to have these tests where we would light a styrofoam ball, you know, like, and then the teacher would grade you, like, as you move the light around the room, like, wasn't even taking the pictures, just moving the lights as an exam. Yeah, it was kind of crazy, but it was interesting, though.
Yeah.
And I can light, like, really well if I need to.
Right. Yeah.
Which, ironically, I don't really use much lighting.
No.
But
you have that.
Yeah. I know how to do it if I need to.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about Larry Sultan and you know, how he was inspirational and an important character in your development?
Definitely. I studied with Larry Sultan at the California College of the Arts and Graduate School. And I knew of his work. And I was kind of in this transitional phase. Actually, anytime anybody goes to graduate school, hopefully they're in a transitional mode of their life, because if they're not, they need to be. Because that's how you get the most out of it. But I was, living on the East Coast in Boston, and I just studied, you know, basically like a very Bauhaus education in photography that like disseminated from Moholy-Nagy, you know, at the Institute of Design, you know, who he hired Callahan to teach. Callahan went to RISD, taught every one of my teachers. And then, so I had this like, you know, hardcore black and white, little print, kind of, you know, modernist education, which was perfect for me at that moment. And then after I got out of school and worked for a couple of years, which I highly advise to people, is to like go out and live and work and pay your rent and all that. I was ready to move to California. And I had seen, there were two big things. And I don't even think I knew what they were. One was I had gotten this Robert Adams book, Los Angeles Spring. I remember like sitting it out and like thinking about it. And I didn't really understand it yet, but I knew there was something in that book that I really loved, which eventually, you know, it became this kind of ruined paradise is what it was. And but with Larry Sultan, there was a show at the Museum of Modern Art, I think it was in 91 or something, like it's called The Pleasures and Terrors of Domestic Comfort. And it was and there was a lot of photography about family photography going on at that time. That's when Sally Mann and Tina Barney and, you know, Larry Sultan, and there was a whole entire exhibition of people that photographed their families. And I remember seeing that, and Larry was kind of highlighted in that show because he had just kind of started doing and finishing up Pictures from Home. And and again, like, I saw that work. Did I understand it fully when I first saw it? Definitely not. But I was drawn to that place. And so I ended up, you know, meeting Larry, and then I went to school there. And it was transformative completely. It changed my work. He pointed me in the direction of like looking back at myself, which is something that I never had really like, never really thought that my pictures were like about me, or, you know, or about my experience, or about, you know, drawing from within is what he would often say. But also somehow or another making work that was universal so that it could be accessible by others. And that's something that I think he did really well. He did it in a very personal way by actually photographing his family. And I think with me, you know, I was interested in going out in the world to shoot. And somehow or another, I figured out how to make pictures of houses that were about people.
Even though there's no people in those pictures.
Yeah,
you know.
And you can never see a person in the window. There's not, it's like everything that, I love that everything anyone's ever imagined is like, they imagined it, because you don't see anything except curtains and light.
The other thing that was interesting to me was that, you know, there was this element of fog that, you know, is very much a part of that part of the world, you know, in I think it's the Bay Area, isn't basically?
Yeah, the San Francisco Bay Area.
That was intrinsic, and I'd never quite realized that this was a very much a kind of recurring, you know, element of the images.
It's an interesting thing, and for me, like, what's curious is, like, it's funny how, like, there's some things, like, you put a few, like, a, you know, like 5 or 10 pictures of fog with 20 pictures of Nakfolk.
Yeah.
And it just permeates like the mood.
Right.
And, you know, and it's interesting. And so like, cause it's funny. One of the things I probably think about most when I'm shooting is like, do it one way and then shoot it sharp also.
Right.
Almost every picture I do, I try to make that happen. Of course, if it's like super foggy, like you can't do anything about that. And sometimes that's joyous to be lost in the fog. I love, you know, I had a morning in Norway like about a year ago that there's 5 pictures in my new book like from that one morning. And that never happens.
Wow, five from one morning, that's quite a hit.
Yeah, out of a 48 picture book.
Yeah.
But so for me, you know, like the fog in California was something that, you know, and I realized that the reason it works for my work is I'm interested in atmosphere. I'm interested in mood. I'm interested in, I guess, setting like a tone that sort of, you know, leads, I guess, to that melancholy feeling that you say you see and plenty of other people do too. And so it's sort of like light is what makes that happen. You know, like you know, I'm looking out behind you right now at the bright, bright sun in Montana with the blue sky. And it's like, I wouldn't go out and take a picture right now.
No, right.
Yeah.
The other person that you've mentioned is Jim Dowd. Is Jim Dowd as an influence?
Jim Dowd's influence on me is very much, I know, one about just like, you know, all the people at the museum school I worked with, like Bill Burke, Jim Dow, Virginia Behan, Sandra Stark, everybody there was very much, they had, talk about work ethic, you know, and then passion for photography. I learned about my passion for photography from them, you know, and then also just the way they did things, you know, and with Jim Dow in particular, with him, his passion for the history of photography and for looking at pictures is probably one of the greater gifts that I have been given in school, because of just like, the history of photography class that he's renowned for. And, you know, it's, back in the day when I was there, like in the early 90s, you know, he had 30,000 slides of the history of photography in his own personal collection. Mm. He didn't mess with the school library. It was like not good enough. And I'm sure he does not use the digital archives they have today. He probably has his own slides. And actually, I talked to a student that went there like about 5 or 6 years ago, and he still does like 6 trays of slides. And he says he doesn't even need to, like, he just talks,
right,
you know, and projects. And he always would say, this is a history of photography for photographers. Don't worry about the names and dates. Just look at the pictures.
Mm. Wow. I can see why that would be incredibly formative.
Yeah.
The other aspect of your work I wanted to sort of touch upon, and I also wanted to ask you about the latest book, Bright Black World. But, you know, you're into this thing of photographing young women, mostly, I think, professional models or people that you knew in some cases in you know, kind of sparse hotel rooms. How did that come about? And you know, what's your kind of, you know, motivation for adding that element to your practice?
I photographed my friends, men friends, and they're not interesting. They're good for lighting and stuff like that. But I kind of quickly discovered that there was a really expressive quality about photographing women that I was interested in. And then also, that's what I'm interested in. You know, like, we're not going to photograph like things that don't keep you up at night, you know, and that's like goes right back to like, why was I driving around in a car, like, you know, like shooting at night, because I was processing a bad childhood, you know, I was processing like relationships that weren't great with my parents and stuff like that. And so, and then I think that, you know, I think I can't imagine not photographing things that you don't have some kind of like, chance of discovering something about yourself or, you know, whatever. And, you know, that's not a conscious thing. It's just something that, like, that I you know, I guess I require that, like, to not be, I'm not mindlessly photographing, you know, the world or any people. And then with the models I ended up working with, many of them were professional models. And because I found that they had something they really wanted to express as well.
Yeah, it's very collaborative. Yeah, yeah, and you know, it's good. It's great to hear you talking. And you know, there's a girl called Christina who you did a whole book with.
Yeah, absolutely. And ironically, like I know, I just did an interview for a film they're doing about her. In Siberia, because she's from there, but she's also was on America's Next Top Model.
Oh, really?
Like the last round, and like she was at the very end, got to the very end of it. So she's remarkable, and she's somebody that, she's a perfect case of like, she talks to me, she's like, I can't wait to work with you. I want to be able to like make art. Mm-hmm. I want to be able to express myself. Like, you're the only person that I actually feel like I'm actually expressive with, even though she takes pictures every day with like another photographer commercially. Like she's very busy.
Do you feel like, you know, there's an element of kind of voyeurism in those images as well, in the same way that there almost is with the houses?
Well, in an odd way, again, the meaning of the art resides in the viewer. If there's something that comes out of that, the viewer is like feeling voyeuristic. For me, I'm just sort of like piecing together a narrative, because I think that things get much more complicated when you have a picture of a place and a picture of a person. And when you start to put those things together, and then maybe there's a picture of, a landscape that has a certain mood to it. And then when you start to weave those things together, there's where that narrative comes from, and it just gets much more rich than just with having, say, just a house. Or just a landscape, or just a person. It's funny, I did that book, Christina's World, with her, and I was going to just include, my intention was to just put pictures of her in there, and it wasn't as interesting, when I had to throw in a few places and a few other things, almost back to what we talked about in the beginning, about like, you need a place for these things to be occurring in.
Yeah, no, it's great to hear the full context and the extent to which, it was a collaborative process. Because, partly I'm wondering whether you've ever had any sort of, pushback from people who go, oh, I get it, male photographer with, young girls half naked in motel, that kind of...
People might consider that, nobody's ever said that to me.
Right.
Because it's very much not what's happening.
No, of course.
Yeah. But and it's not my midlife crisis book, anything like that. That's the beauty of being like doing what you've wanted to do is like, I don't think I'm going to have one.
Right.
Because I just have I have no regrets about the way my life has gone.
Okay. Well, that's great to know. So we haven't got much time. We do have to keep it fairly short, because normally I would talk for a full hour, but. I'd love to hear a little bit about Bright Black World, because that is your kind of latest book. And I'm wondering about, how it came to be and what the sort of general thought process was behind creating it.
In a nutshell, like the way that why it's different and how it came about is that I had, Aperture did a mid-career survey of my work called Intimate Distance.
Yep. I have the book. I love it.
Thank you very much. Yeah. And it was, and it was a really wonderful opportunity to like just sort of like, okay, halfway through me doing this, let's look at what I've done and let's organize it, sort it, think about it, and we did it chronologically, which was really important. But after you do something like that, you're sort of like, well, we've kind of buttoned up a couple of things. We've edited things that like things there's a certain like finishing of something process that occurs with that. And very much for me, that was like, okay, I felt like I was at a moving on point from the other work that I had done, the suburban work and the portraits. I mean, I still do those things. I still do all this stuff. But like I talked about, before, like I often tend to focus on something. I get a focus. And so I was remarkably kind of after this process of editing it all down, I felt like it was like, okay, well, what should I do next? And then I had always been sort of like bound to this thing that I felt like almost every one of my pictures that I've made prior to the, you know, the Bright Black World, it referred to some memory for me. Mm. It referred to the past. It referred to a place, to a person. And that's what I was doing, you know. And then when you cut that cord right there, it's quite interesting what happened for me, is because I never really photographed all those other pictures like prior to Bright Black World. Everyone was made in America, you know, and even though I traveled all over the place, everyone was made in America because that's where it looked good for me. I remember going to Marseille and, like, you know, doing a residency and just nothing worked at all because, yeah, you know, I had no memories in France, you know, mm, south of France wasn't working. But that was I was young when that happened, but like, not that I'm old either, but yeah. But anyway, it was, you know, 20 years ago. And, but with this work, as soon as I sort of got that cord cut, in my head, which is like, you know, it's all in your head, but I started to see everything, you know, and the political climate that we're in right now, which I fully disagree with. And then I also think that, like, there's something going on in the world that is just darkening, you know, and I'm an optimist, you know, for sure. But, and then the climate, you know, all the things happening, you know, there's almost no way to not, like, turn my camera towards making pictures that sort of got at this, like, mm-hmm, this quagmire we're in that's very, very real. And I think that, that's where that work comes from. And then kind of, but like, you know, with all work, you know, you have a feeling and then, but you still need to sort of, like, there's still something that needs to be behind it. And I had read an A.S. Byatt book called Ragnarok. And there was one of the very last things that she described in this, the Nordic mythology of like Fimbulwinter, which is the endless apocalyptic winter, she was describing the light. And she said, and she was describing the snowfall that just never ended. And she was, you know, it was getting darker and darker. And she, you know, she had those three words. It was a bright black world. And out of this entire book, there's those three words. I sort of was like, bingo, that is what I am doing. Mm. You know, because I was making the pictures already,
right.
You know, but I didn't have any words to hang my hat on, you know. And yeah, I think that's, for a photographer, for me especially, if I can find a few little words to put like to hang my pictures on or to like use as a lasso sort of to pull them in, it's really remarkably helpful in editing and then shooting. And then that usually happens kind of halfway through something. And then it sort of gives you like more direction in shooting, you know? So yeah, I basically traveled, you know, to, you know, Norway. I traveled to the North Sea of Japan. I went to Iceland. I went to, I shot in Ohio where I come from, a lot of shots, and a lot of it was wintertime. Actually, almost all of it is, and because that's what was drawing me. And mm-hmm, and so it's a project that I just completed. The book just came out like 6 months ago, and I'm really, really pleased with the way that it, that my work was able to shift into something that I never imagined it would be. That's actually, I haven't thought about that till just now, but is it sometimes there's something remarkable about when you look back at what you did, you're like, gee, I never would have, you told me 5 years ago I was going to make that. I would have been like, really? Are you like, I don't know about that, you know? And then all of a sudden, well, there it is, you know? So I think that that's a good way to end it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Todd, thank you. It's been a great pleasure talking to you. I know my listeners will love to, you know, hear your contribution to the podcast. And I really massively appreciate you making the time to chat. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you very much.